Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A deadly car bomb shatters the growing calm in Baghdad. Congress investigates the origins of harsh interrogation techniques used at Guantanamo and in Iraq. Egypt brokers a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and Afghan and U.S.-led forces beat back advances by the Taliban. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, NPR's Tom Gelton, James Kitfield of the National Journal, and Dimitri Sevastopoulos of the Financial Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
There's a story on the front page of the New York Times that a major Israeli military exercise took place that might have been a rehearsal for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. What can you tell us about it, Dimitri?
Well, the New York Times reported this morning that there was, a large exercise involving, roughly 100 Israeli fighter jets refueling tanker aircraft, and the kind of aircraft you would use for rescue, search and rescue missions if, for example, one of your pilots was shot down over enemy territory. The difficulties with these stories is you cannot tell whether, in this case, Israel is actually preparing for an attack on Iran or whether they're trying to scare Iran and put more pressure on the U.S. and the west of Europe, particularly, to put pressure on Iran. It could be a combination of both. We don't know. But certainly it raises the specter in the region that you could have some kind of military action before the end of the Bush administration.
James Kitfield.
Well, I agree with that. And I would be surprised if there's an attack imminent, because basically the 2003 National Intelligence estimate said that Iran had, for the time being at least, suspended its nuclear weapons design work, not its enrichment, but its design work. So the timing seems unusual to me, and Israel is involved in all these other negotiations in the region with Hamas and Hezbollah and Syria. However, you know, you have to take this very seriously. Israel has done this twice before. It attacked the Iraqi reactor in the 1980s. It recently bombed Syrian what was believed to be a nuclear facility. So Israel is looking at Iran. Iran's president has said, we want to wipe them off the map, but they should be wiped off the map. And they're taking this very seriously, and I take it seriously.
Tom.
Well, Diane, I think we have to look at it in the context of a couple of things. One is that there is very broad concern in Israel about the threat that Iran represents. And that's a bipartisan concern. And there have been a number of Israeli officials in recent weeks who have been quoted as saying that a nuclear weapons program in Iran would be intolerable for Israel. So there is bipartisan support in Israel for the prospect of some kind of military action against Iran. That's one thing to keep in mind. The second thing, and we're going to get to this later in the program, Diane, but there have been a number of peace developments in Israel recently that just happened to all be taking place along the western flank of Israel, from the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria. And there has been some speculation that if Israel were serious about military action against Iran, one of the first things it would want to do is to pacify that entire western flank so it could really concentrate on action against Iran. Who knows if that's the motivation, but I think you do have to consider these two developments in tandem.
I would just add to that even if Israel could pacify the western flank in that way, that pacification could be turned up on its head overnight if there was a strike on Iran. I think it would ignite the region in ways that you can't predict. And that's been one of the concerns of senior U.S. military commanders over the past few years, is what are the implications of a strike on Iran? You can take out some of their nuclear targets, but what happens next?
Well, that's exactly right. The blowback from this attack is what scared us a little bit. Our military really doesn't want any part of this right now. They have their hands full. But you have to assume they've got proxies in Hezbollah, so Hezbollah would probably I agree with Dmitry totally. They would, any truce that they had reached with Israel would probably be broken immediately. They have been supporting Hamas, and you can imagine the Gaza Strip then, you know, reigniting. And they've been supporting these Shia militias in Iraq. So, and Iran has been very, very open about threatening to do that very thing if they were attacked. And the third thing they could do is obviously attack oil shipping through the Persian Gulf and through the Straits of Hormuz. And if they do that, you know, prepare for wishful days of $5 a gallon.
So at the same time, you have former UN weapons inspector David Albright drafting a report saying that the AQ Khan network may have sold blueprints for a sophisticated nuclear bomb, and those bomb parts may have gone to Libya, Iran, and North Korea, Tom.
What do we know, Diane? According to David Albright's reporting, and he's been, he's actually writing a book on this and has been following it very closely for the last several years. What we know from his reporting is that the AQ Khan network actually had those blueprints for a small nuclear warhead, a powerful one that could fit on top of the type of missiles that Iran and North Korea have been developing. Now, what this raises an intriguing possibility, something that James mentioned earlier. The United States found, the United States intelligence community believes that Iran suspended its weapons design work in 2003. Now, this raises the question, did Iran suspend this because it had gotten these blueprints? And that the blueprints alone are not all that it would take to build that warhead. But perhaps there is some speculation that if it got these blueprints, then it was less urgent for it to move on this weaponization research. That might be an explanation. That's the thing people are really worried about.
And Dmitry, you broke a story yesterday on missing nuclear parts in this country.
Well, Diane, there was an investigation several months ago after it emerged that the U.S. had accidentally shipped four nose cones for a Minuteman nuclear missile to Taiwan. The Taiwanese had ordered helicopter batteries, and when they opened the package, they got a surprise. In the course of that investigation, a senior Navy admiral and his team discovered that there were possibly over 1,000 components of nuclear missiles that were unaccounted for. Now, the Pentagon is since trying to play down the story. They're saying it's a problem with paperwork. Just because we don't have a paper trail doesn't mean we don't know where they are. But when they're asked specifically, how can you say that they haven't fallen into the hands, or they haven't been lost, or they haven't been stolen, if you don't have a paper trail to tell you where they are? And they don't have an answer for that.
How does this, or how might it, relate to the firing of the two Air Force officials earlier this month, James?
Well, I actually had a chance to interview the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and there are a lot of things that the Air Force is kind of in the doghouse with the Secretary of Defense, and we asked him, you know, were there other reasons besides this? And he kept saying, no, it was this sense that there's a laxity that has sort of gotten into the Air Force culture in terms of its nuclear deterrent, and they said that it has to be reversed, and we have to make an example of these people. Can I just make a point on the Albright issue? What struck me, two things about that struck me as being particularly worrisome, one of which was they found these plans on a computer, an electronic file. You can download that and email it to anyone in the world. So the question is, it's not only that they have dealt with Libya and North Korea and Iran, but did they, you know, was an Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda has basically said they will pay top dollar for something like this. We have no assurances that that didn't happen. And secondly, Tom and I were at a briefing this week with an intelligence expert in the administration who said they're not at all comfortable that the AQ Khan network has been totally rolled up. They haven't been able to interview this guy, and there's signs of worry in his comments very directly that this network may not be totally rolled up.
James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Tom Jelton, correspondent for NPR, Dmitry Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for Financial Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Finally, do any of you expect Israel to act against Iran? Dmitry?
If I had to bet my life on it, I would say no, but I would rather not bet my life on it.
I actually think there's a better than 50-50 chance, but not this year, not before Bush is out of office. But at some point, when it comes clear that Iran's going down this road, it's going to get a nuclear weapon, I take Israel seriously when it says we cannot abide that.
I really agree with both Dmitry and James. There is one other caveat to throw in there, which is that Israel, of course, does not border Iran. And in order for it to attack Iran, it would have to fly over the airspace of Iraq, among other countries. Interestingly enough, I don't know if we're going to get to this, the question of who controls Iraqi airspace is one of those that's being negotiated right now between the United States and the Iraqi government.
How are those negotiations going, Tom?
Well, they don't seem to be going very well. The Iraqi government has said that they're at an impasse, but on the other hand, President Bush keeps coming out and saying that he's not worried about it, we can reach a compromise. There are some very difficult issues that have to be resolved. There doesn't seem to be any panic yet on the part of the Bush administration about it.
Dan, I'd just like to point out that normally when the U.S. is negotiating these kinds of status enforcement and security agreements with other countries, even peaceful countries like, for example, Japan, it takes a long time. It often takes more than a year. So the idea that they will be able to rush this through with the Iraqis, given the complexities of that situation and the problems between the two countries, I think is probably very optimistic.
Isn't the idea of the establishment of permanent bases one of the sticking issues?
Actually, it's not. I mean, I talked to senior guy officials in the Pentagon who were involved in these close to these negotiations, and they say that's not really the sticking point. They were asked, you know, how many facilities do you have in country? And they came up with this number 200, but that's everything from, you know, a small street, you know, outpost in a neighborhood to a major logistics base. And the Iraqis kind of threw up their hands, and I think that plays well to their base, you know, to stand up to America plays well politically for them with elections approaching in the fall. I think the sticking point really is how much operational freedom does America retain in terms of launching its own offensives, in terms of detaining Iraqis. That right now is the biggest sticking point.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about no-bid oil contracts in Iraq. Take your calls and email. Stay with us. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, this week with James Kitfield of National Journal, Dmitry Sevastopoulou of Financial Times, and Tom Jelton of NPR. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Dmitry, what can you tell us about the four Western oil companies about to sign no-bid contracts with the government of Iraq? First of all, how come it's just Western companies, and how come they're no-bid?
Well, it's a decision the Iraqi government, the Iraqi oil ministry has taken. They did look, and they have been talking to roughly, I think, 40 companies from around the world, including Russia, China, and other countries. They eventually selected ExxonMobil, Shell, Total, BP, and I hear that Chevron is also interested. I think this is interesting for several reasons. It tells you, one, with the very high oil prices around the world, the impetus for these companies to get into Iraq has grown dramatically. It also tells you that the level of violence in Iraq has subsided to an extent that allows these oil companies to feel that they can take the risk. And I think the risk cost balance, risk-reward balance, I should say, has changed in Iraq. These contracts are going to be 1 or 2 year contracts to service Iraqi oil fields to try and help them increase their production. But they will give the companies a large toehold in Iraq and then put them in pole position, I think, to get longer-term concessions, which they haven't had for 36 years since Saddam Hussein nationalized the industry.
I certainly don't want to defend this, Diane, but I think we should point out the rationale for it, which is that the Iraqi oil infrastructure is in terrible shape and has been really neglected over the years. And these companies do represent the best expertise, and they have the best technology. So it makes sense from an Iraqi point of view to bring in the companies that are that have the best capability to really help them improve their infrastructure. And as Dmitry says, the contracts are to service the oil fields. And these companies certainly have the expertise and technology to do that.
But could this not reinforce the image that the U.S. went into Iraq for the oil?
It definitely does reinforce that image, and it's unfortunate that the Iraqi oil ministry kind of faced a position where it could either look bad or it could get something done, and they're very desperate to get something done. I'll also say that, you know, the Secretary Rice said that the Americans really didn't pressure on this at all, and I see no reason yet to believe that's not true. But the Iraqis are very cognizant of the fact that it would look very bad having us gone in there, sort of liberated them, put this government in place, have 140,000 troops in country to start giving contracts to Gazprom from Russia. It would not look very well, wouldn't play well with our Congress, and they're not foolish about that.
James, I know you did a story this week about the two campaigns, the two nominees, Barack Obama and John McCain, and how they would deal with the Iraq question. Barack Obama had a conversation with Iraq's foreign minister this week. What did they talk about?
Well, they talked about what his position would be and what would happen if he becomes president. And you know, the Iraqi foreign minister came out of that meeting saying very conciliatory things, that he was reassured that President Obama would not do anything rash, would not, upset the apple cart too much. I think the sort of backstory to this is Senator McCain has been gaining some traction by saying Barack Obama has stuck to the same policy in Iraq for 16 months. He hasn't been back to Iraq for 2.5 years, and he's got this. He's wedded to this narrative of we have to get out of a failing enterprise. Well, a lot's happened in Iraq in that time frame, and I think Mr. Obama wants to sort of change the narrative slightly. He said he will go to Iraq, obviously not with Senator McCain, which is a very smart move, but he will go to Iraq, and he apparently is sending signals that he wants to be out by 16 months, but he's left himself a fair amount of wiggle room, saying that circumstances on the ground may cause him to slip that schedule. He's also said he's going to leave a residual force for hunting al-Qaeda and supporting the Iraqi security forces. I asked Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, you know, given present trends, the difference between Senator Obama's 16-month timetable that may slip a year or two and Senator McCain's timetable, which is I want most troops out by the end of my first term in 2013, the gap between those two may be narrower than first appears.
I agree with that completely. I think as the violence has subsided in Iraq, it has brought the positions of the candidates in that sense closer. The key test will be later in the year as we get close to November and the election approaches. If violence starts to spike in Iraq again, then you will see a huge diversion between Senator McCain's plan for going forward and what Senator Obama wants to do. At the moment, it's converging.
But I guess I agree with Dmitry and James. However, I haven't seen any evidence that Obama is backtracking from the idea of 1 to 2 brigade withdrawals a month and having all combat forces out in 16 months. I mean, he has hinted at that, but he's still, if you look at his campaign website and at the responses that his foreign policy people make when you ask him about this, he is still sticking to that formula. And it was even hard for him to understand what went on in this conversation between Obama and Hoshea Zebari, the Iraqi foreign minister, because the two of them afterwards gave very different accounts of that conversation. Zebari said he'd been reassured, and he said that Obama said he wasn't going to act precipitously, but Obama came out and he said that he had told him, quote, we will move to end U.S. combat forces in Iraq. So I think that this position still is not quite defined yet.
What is happening in Iraq? We know that we hear reports that things are quieting down And yet this morning, a car bomb in Baghdad, that was Tuesday, killed more than 60 people. Who was behind that? Do we know?
Well, Dan, if you look at the numbers, it's interesting. The numbers of U.S. military casualties has gone down dramatically. The number of Iraqi civilian casualties has gone down dramatically. The number of casualties of Iraqi security forces has gone up significantly as U.S. forces have been leaving the country. What that tells you is that Nouri al-Malkani, the Iraqi prime minister, has been sending his troops into Basra in the south, then Sadr City, Shia enclaves, then up to Mosul, where there are so-called al-Qaeda remnants and Sunni insurgents, and now into the city of Amara on the southeast of the country, very close with the border with Iran, where the US believes weapons have been coming across. So the Iraqis seem to be taking more responsibility for their security. And when Maliki launched his initial operation in Basra, he was slammed by the Americans. General Petraeus on Capitol Hill even said it hadn't been planned very well. Now, 4 months later, 3 months later, I think people are reassessing that and saying, you know something, actually he's done a better job than people expected originally.
You know, there's been an important change in the fighting, a pattern of fighting in Iraq. Whereas in the previous months, U.S. and Iraqi forces were targeting Sunni groups. Now the target has been, as Dmitry said, it's been these Shiite militia groups. And the country that has really sort of lost influence in that has been Iran. And so U.S. commanders are now speculating, and I haven't seen any evidence to support their reasoning, that Iran has an interest now in sort of reigniting this sectarian violence between Sunni and Shiite, because that's the condition under which they can further their own interests. So there's been, again, this speculation from the U.S. military that Iran may have been behind somehow this car bombing, with the idea that the Shia would blame the Sunnis for it and therefore reignite that sectarian violence. Mm.
Which is very, to me, that's hugely important, because the initial reaction was this must be Sunni al-Qaeda, because it was a very Shia area that they launched this bombing in. Turns out if the Americans are telling the truth, and they're naming names, which usually a pretty signal they've got pretty good intelligence, if this is a Shiite special group with ties to Iran killing fellow Shia, that is not going to make Iran particularly popular with the Shia population. So I think, you know, the fact that the Maliki government has shown a certain equanimity by also attacking these Sadrist groups, the Shia Sadrist groups, has really elevated not only his own popularity, but it's made the Iraqi security forces probably the most popular institution inside Iraq right now. And that's the confidence you hear when Iraqis say, you know, you Americans, if you want to drive a hard bargain on the status of forces, you can leave. They're getting more and more confident that in the foreseeable future that the Iraqi security forces can do the job. And that's exactly basically what we want. So there's a pretty good trend line right now, I would say, in Iraq.
And talk about what's happening in Afghanistan, Dmitry.
Well, Diane, last Friday evening I was having a drink with a friend and I got a call saying there'd been a breakout in a prison in Afghanistan and over 1,000 prisoners had been freed, which was a fairly important story. And then NATO forces with Afghan troops went in and they've tried to round up some of these Taliban who fled from the prison in Kandahar, which is the original capital of the Taliban, not capital, but their stronghold, and have tried to beat them back. It's not clear what that means for the long term in that region, but certainly a lot more people on the loose. So I think the bigger issue in Afghanistan is the border area with Afghanistan and Pakistan, where you have extremists, militants, Taliban, al-Qaeda, going back and forth in a kind of a lawless area that's not under the control of the Afghans, the Americans, or the Pakistanis. And that is where the real trouble is coming from.
Diane, General Dan McNeil, who's the outgoing commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, on his exit basically gave a very downbeat assessment of the situation in Afghanistan and was very hard on the Pakistanis. He pointed out that attacks on U.S. and Afghan forces have gone up in these border regions, and he blamed it squarely on the Pakistani government for not cracking down on extremists in that border area. He even went, now James had this interview with Admiral Mullen, and it seems that sort of the current serving people are watching their words a little bit more carefully. He was not nearly as hard on the Pakistanis, but General McNeil is more free to speak now. He's on his way out, and he left it very clear that the situation is bad, and he blamed the Pakistanis.
I agree with all that. I was struck by a couple of things, one of which is the Taliban. You know, we've been talking about a stalemate in Afghanistan, and this is another sign it is stalemated. The Taliban can do these kinds of attacks. We need more forces over there that we don't have. Admiral Mullen was very, very serious about we need another brigade or two at least in Afghanistan. We don't have them. They're in Iraq. So that's another reason why I think a Senator McCain would be encouraged to pull, you know, keep a downward trend of pullouts from Iraq because he needs troops in Afghanistan. Secondly, but he just had come back, Admiral Mullen had come back from Pakistan, and he said the same thing. You know, we are absolutely fed up with the sanctuaries that these guys have. However, it's a new government in Pakistan. They are a sovereign government, and they have signed the ceasefire again with Taliban leaders. So he's arguing patience, but he's sending signals at the same time that their patience is not going to last forever.
Dan, one of the big problems the U.S. military has is you've got a new chief of the army in Pakistan, General Kiani, who they think wants to push the Pakistani army in the right direction, which means less of a focus on India, more of a focus on counterinsurgency, which is the same debate in the U.S. military. They praised him to the hilt initially when he came in. In the last month or so, they've kind of eased off on the praise publicly because they've realized praising General Kiani in public makes it more difficult for him in Pakistan to move the military in the direction that the U.S. wants it to go. So you've got a very interesting kind of subtle war of words or negotiations going back between the two countries right now, I think.
Tom, we talked earlier about Israel and what it's done in regard to Iran, but there is a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, and that seems to be holding for the second day.
Yeah, we're about 36 hours into it. So far, so good. Neither the Palestinians nor the Israelis seem to have much confidence in this. But it's a ceasefire that, in a sense, makes sense for both sides. You know, the Israeli settlements along the Gaza area have been hit by so many rocket attacks that they, of course, really welcome any kind of respite from those attacks. And Hamas is gaining a lot, too. Israel has had this siege of the Gaza Strip in effect for a long time now, and if they can resolve that and sort of give their own people a little bit of relief, that's going to improve their standing, and they're sort of having to worry about their popularity with their own people.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and let's talk about the hearings this week on the origins of harsh interrogations used at Guantanamo and in Iraq. What did we learn?
Diane, it was fascinating. We had a lot of people testify, but the two or three more interesting ones, I would say, we had Alberto Mora, the retired general counsel of the Navy, and we had the former general counsel of the Pentagon, William Haynes. Alberto Mora is widely considered to be one of the people inside the Pentagon who was trying to push the military away from the idea of using harsh techniques such as waterboarding and things like that. William Haynes, who now works at Chevron, to speak of oil companies, he was seen as one of the people pushing to have aggressive techniques. But the most interesting thing we learned was that before, in the end of 2002, as the Pentagon was trying to find new techniques to use on Mohammed al-Qahtani, the so-called 20th hijacker, they had a series of meetings that involved CIA lawyers. And one of the CIA lawyers said, and I want to read this, when he was describing waterboarding, he said, it can feel like drowning. The lymphatic system will react as if you're suffocating, but your body will not cease to function. Then he said, in trying to describe whether the U.S. would be in violation of anti-torture laws by using such harsh techniques, he said, it's basically subject to perception. If the detainee dies, you're doing it wrong. And Senator Levin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, took that statement and he said, how can the U.S. be having discussions like that?
Not only Senator Levin, Senator Graham said the guidance, and he's referring to the CIA legal guidance, the guidance that was provided during this period of time will go down in history as some of the most irresponsible and short-sighted legal analysis ever provided to our nation's military and intelligence communities.
Something else that I think this testimony, along with some things we've learned in recent months from reporting, Vanity Fair reported in September of 2002, all of these top lawyers, Haynes included, also Gonzalez, a guy from the Justice Department, Gonzalez was then in the White House, went down to Guantanamo and basically told them they wanted more information coming out of there. These are the top-level lawyers in the government. So this narrative that they've stuck to, that this kind of these harsh techniques bubbled up from overzealous commanders on the ground, is totally been blown out of the water now. Now we have, shortly after, these lawyers from the top, you know, Addington from the vice president's office, down in Guantanamo, the CIA lawyer shows up and says the things that Dmitry said. So it's very clear this was coming from the very, very top of the Bush administration.
One of the reasons we know they were doing this, Diane, is that they, William Haynes and some of the other senior officials, they asked the military what techniques they could learn from the military school, which is called the Survival, Evasion, Resistance and Escape Training Program, which is used for some military officers who may be captured overseas in certain kind of circumstances. So they train these guys on how to resist interrogation, how to resist torture. And waterboarding is one of the things that they use. So William Haynes and some of these other officials asked the military command that's responsible for this program, tell us about these techniques. How can we use them? The problem is this training is to train you how to resist the techniques. It's not telling you how to interrogate people. And FBI interrogators would say that the best way to interrogate someone is to build rapport. It's not to punish them.
You know, there's something else to keep in mind here, Diane, and that's that there's a cultural change, a cultural difference between the U.S. military and the intelligence community in regard to these interrogations and how to pursue them. The U.S. military has been very uncomfortable from the beginning with targeting these guys as enemy combatants, as not extending them POW status, because they're worried that this creates precedents for how U.S. personnel might be treated. And remember that right now, a lot of this debate, of course, is about 2002, 2003. But there is a current issue which is unresolved, and that is what regulations CIA interrogators are going to be bound by, the U.S. military Army field manual or their own regulations. That is still unresolved.
Tom Chelton of NPR. When we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And by the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The American Film Institute has issued its list of top American films in 10 different genres, including epics, sci-fi, westerns, romantic comedy, and gangster movies. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis on the epic Spartacus, and with Sigourney Weaver on the science fiction film Alien. That and more on the next Fresh Air.
And we're back with the Friday News Roundup. Here's an email from Mark in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who says, I hope you'll discuss the statement this week by General Antonio Taguba, the man who investigated Abu Ghraib.
He was very, he investigated Abu Ghraib. He came out with a very, hard-hitting report. And a lot of people think that was the end of his career in the Rumsfeld Pentagon when he came out with that report. And there were congressional hearings, and he became a big star saying this was wrong and we need to do something about this. Shortly after that was shown the door, was not promoted beyond that. And he came out and said very strongly, and I don't have it in front of me. So I do.
He said that there is no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account, Dimitri.
Well, Diane, that's a pretty strong statement.
I think
whether anyone in this administration will be held to account will primarily depend on who the next president is. Interestingly, both Senator Obama and Senator McCain have been very tough on this issue. Senator McCain, in particular, tortured in Vietnam, has been one of the leading advocates of pushing back against the administration, trying to prohibit their ability to use harsh techniques. He was successful with the Army. He was less successful in getting something vis-a-vis the CIA, as Tom just pointed out. But this is going to be an interesting issue. Will the next president prosecute former officials? We don't know.
Now, here's what the Wall Street Journal had to say about this. It and an editorial, it said the political motive here is transparent, if deeply cynical. Having failed to force a withdrawal from Iraq, and with Iraq now turning into a success, Democrats need a different line of attack to please their anti-war supporters. The torture narrative has become a left-wing favorite.
I would just say one thing. The two leading critics of this administration on interrogation have been John McCain, Republican senator, and Lindsey Graham, Republican senator.
All right, let's go to Sheila in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Okay, a lot of this comes down to just following the money. And with that said, the GSA did a report that 25% of the Pentagon budget has not even been traced. They don't know where the money's gone. And this all wraps up into Iraq and Iran. There's trillions of dollars that are missing. And I'm really concerned about accountability. Why is it that we do not have auditors in place to find out about the torture? Because it costs money to torture people. It costs money to keep them incarcerated. I think that all of this stuff that's going on with that, nuclear weapon heads that are turning around and being shipped to who knows where at taxpayers' expense, it's really very unconscionable.
I actually think that's a. I get the point. You should follow the money. I think we can see the operational budget of Guantanamo. That's not particularly classified, and it doesn't take that much money to torture someone. Unfortunately, she's quite right. The accountability is tough because the Pentagon, and I've done this story before, is a bunch of fiefdoms in each service, and getting their handle on accounting for the billions and billions of dollars they spend every year, they've never really done that. So every time the GAO investigates, they can come up with these great headlines that the Pentagon cannot account for so much money. I don't think it's running around out there in slush funds. I think it's inefficiency primarily.
Well, Diane, we also had a story this week in which one of the former auditors or inspectors of U.S. Civilian contracting in Iraq said that he had stopped payments to KBR, which is a huge defense contractor providing services in Iraq, because he said he saw no justification for what they were being billed, no evidence for it. He said he could not authorize the payments to them under those conditions. And basically, he got drummed out and his objections were overruled and KBR got the money anyway.
So Sheila really has a good point.
Well, I think it is a massive bureaucracy. It's very inefficient. And quite frankly, it doesn't appear to have the amount of resources needed to have the kind of auditing or inspector general function that you really need for that amount of a budget. I mean, it's huge budget.
Can I just clarify, too, because there are two issues here, one of which is this huge unaccountability for the defense budget. Here in the States, the Pentagon's budget. That's what I was referring to. Iraq, There were built tens of billions of dollars unaccounted for in Iraq that no one will ever find because there was no accounting in place when we went in there. And you saw just hordes of money thrown around there. It was all about getting something done and worry about the accountants tomorrow. So if you're talking about Iraq, there has been a huge lack of accountability.
Let's go now to Syracuse, New York. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hello. My question actually goes back a little bit, back to the nuclear plans that were evidently given out. My question is actually, were they ever received by anybody? The nuclear testing that went on by North Korea actually was looked to be actually ineffective and not use that kind of technology. So how do we actually know? I'll take my answer off the air.
Tom.
We don't know, Diane. And actually, we were talking about David Albright's report. He and I spoke to him at some length. He's very clear. There is no evidence, for example, that Iran got those blueprints. We don't. There's no evidence really that we know of. Now, who knows what the intelligence communities may have. But there's no evidence we know of that anyone in particular got those blueprints. It's more the concern than direct knowledge.
All right. Let's go to Ross in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi there.
Hi. I want to talk today is Refugee Day. The killing and violence in Iraq goes up and down, but there are now 4.5 million Iraqis who have desperately fled their homes in the largest Middle East exodus in decades. And I find it so disheartening that these pundits who discuss everything in chess and football terms of simple strategy and winning completely strip any humanity out of the picture. This is an illegal occupation of a sovereign country. It is a crime, and it is the fuel for the insurgency. And you cannot make a crime better. You can only end it. And this illegal war and occupation has killed perhaps up to 1 million Iraqis. Winter Soldier, which took place here in Silver Spring, was ignored by the media to their shame, just as they ignored all critics and peace activists.
All right. Thanks for your call, Dimitri.
Diane, I think Ross raises a really interesting point, which is, as the violence has continued in Iraq, you've had different communities that lived together for years have now started to split apart, and people have moved out to different neighborhoods or moved to Jordan or to other countries. One of the biggest challenges for the Iraqi government is going to be, how do you reintegrate the people who are now living in overseas back into Iraq? And quite frankly, I'm surprised the U.S. hasn't done a little bit more to bring more refugees to the U.S., given what's happened.
And especially those individuals who are in Iraq as translators acting in behalf of the U.S. in secret, who've tried to get here and have not been allowed to come. Let's go now to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning, Jay. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you. I want to go back to the process of the contract given to the big four Western companies. The gentleman spoke about the Iraqi oil ministry and that in their perspective, this was the best thing to do. My understanding is that there are some American representatives within the oil ministry. Is that correct, or can you comment on that?
Yeah, there are American liaisons in all the Iraqi ministries, obviously. We're trying to help them stand up very nascent ministries. But yes, there are advisors from the U.S. government in the Iraqi oil ministry.
Does that answer it? I guess he has gone on. What about the Saudis, who have reportedly said they'll increase their oil output? How significant might that be?
Diane, I think it depends how much they actually increase it by. I think they've said
500,000
barrels per day.
More likely 200,000.
Exactly, and that's what has been rather confusing.
Yeah.
And how important is that? How significant?
Well, the only way it would, 200,000 barrels a day is not going to make much of a difference unless other countries follow their lead. And so far, what we've seen in the last few days since this announcement leaked out, and actually hasn't been made yet, it would come on Sunday at a big oil ministers meeting in Jeddah. But so far, we see very little interest on the part of other oil producers to follow suit. And we can see from what's happened in the oil market oil traders certainly don't believe it's going to make much of a difference because the price of oil has not come down at all.
You know, here's an interesting email from Jeff in Annandale, Virginia, who says, when the U.S. entered the war against Iraq, Bush administration officials indicated oil revenues were expected to pay for a major part of the reconstruction, with the price of oil more than doubled since the invasion. Has the Iraq reconstruction effort benefited at all from surging oil prices, Dimitri?
Diane, they have actually had a windfall from the surging oil prices, even though their production is not at the levels that the Americans hoped it would be by now. The problem is they haven't been able to spend it for whatever reason, a combination of incompetence, inefficiency, corruption. And one of the points that congressmen in Capitol Hill and the US are making is, why is the US paying for certain things in Iraq when Iraq actually now has a surplus budget because of the oil profits?
Here's another email, this one not signed, which says there seems little support of the Gaza ceasefire from either the U.S. government or the U.S. media in terms of encouragement or coverage. While the ceasefire could be a momentous event, why is there not the level of excitement that would be extended to a military campaign?
Well, these ceasefire agreements or negotiations happen behind closed doors, so it's hard to cover them until they actually come out with, you know, a product, or they fail to come out with a product. And that's part of that. I think that, you know, Secretary Rice did blatantly say that this is a good thing. You know, they were in a stalemate. The rockets were coming from Gaza. The Israeli retaliation was coming back. No one saw a way out of that cycle of violence except to talk to Hamas. What I was struck by in that whole debate was you had President Bush go to the Israeli Knesset and basically say to talk to these people would be appeasing. Obviously referring to Barack Obama and his discussion about talking to the Iranians. At the same time, the Israelis who were hosting him were talking to Hamas, they were talking to Hezbollah, they were talking to Syria. It kind of puts the lie to this idea that by not talking to people, you can actually succeed in getting your way. It hasn't worked very well for the Israelis, and so they're talking.
Yeah, I think this is one of those indications of the diminishing influence of a lame duck administration. But again, I think the important thing is to put this in a larger strategic context. We're talking about the Arab-Israeli conflict. If all of these, the talks with Syria, Lebanon, and Hamas, were to be resolved, that would really resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is a deep, deep conflict that's gone on for so many years. So, you know, in a sense, I appreciate the callers, the emailers' concern. This is really a potentially historic development, and I do think it's linked to concern on the part of many Arab nations about Iran's growing influence.
I do hope that ceasefire holds. And I think that's what people are worried about, as they don't want to overplay because they are concerned lest something fall apart. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show and to Arlington, Texas. Hi there, Judy. You're on the air. Judy, are you there?
Yes, in Arlington, Texas?
Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you. My issue is torture. Who evaluates the effects on the personnel who inflict the torture? How changed are these people when they come home?
I'm not sure if you mean the people who are actually doing the interrogating.
The people that are inflicting the torture, the beatings, or the actual motion of torturing these people, how...
I think that's an interesting question. I think that the number of people who are doing these interrogations are probably relatively limited. I'm not sure they are known to a wide number of people within the U.S. government. And I suspect that I suspect there has not been a program to evaluate the kind of post-traumatic stress disorder that they may have suffered from interrogations.
Well, there was one interrogator who was involved in interrogating Al-Qaeda suspects in the 2002-2003 time frame, who had such bad feelings about what he had personally witnessed and done that he spoke out about it, I believe, on 60 Minutes, Mr. Kiriakou, who made a lot of news saying he was one of the first to actually describe waterboarding and how it worked, and from a perspective of having seen it.
We had an interrogator on this program just the other day who described it precisely, but said that his manner of interrogating was to, as you referred to, Dimitri, gain rapport with the individual, and that was the best way to glean the greatest amount of information.
Diane, that's certainly what the FBI says, and there are a number of people within the CIA who would share that view. I think the problem for the US military and the CIA earlier on was they didn't have patience, and you need to have patience to develop rapport. They wanted answers quickly. They were concerned that a year after the 9/11 attacks, there might be another attack, an anniversary attack. And so they wanted to get answers quickly. And so I think that's one of the reasons they resorted to trying these other techniques when patience might have been the better approach.
Do you believe that that kind of treatment of prisoners continues?
We don't know. I mean, we certainly with the CIA program, we don't know. We've heard a CIA lawyer describe torture as something that you can describe, you know, is very subjective and open to perception. And we have not seen this. The CIA has still carved out a black hole for what it's doing, and the Bush administration has carved it out for them. We know what the military is doing, and the military certainly has changed its modus operandi and gotten out of the really harsh interrogation techniques. But we really don't know what the CIA is doing.
The CIA has said it stopped waterboarding. That may or may not be true, but we don't know what other techniques they use. So how do we know? We just don't know. It's a black hole, as James said.
Yes, and General Hayden has been very explicit in saying he does not want his interrogators to be constrained by the Army Field Manual. And the fact that he wants to have the authority to do things that aren't allowed under the Army Field Manual raises exactly these questions.
Tom Gelton, he's correspondent for NPR. James Kitfield, he's senior correspondent for National Journal Magazine, and Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for Financial Times. What a disturbing notion to end on. But I hope you all have a peaceful weekend.
Thank you, Diane.
You too.
Thanks
Diane.
For being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.